How do you think children with autism experience the world?
Like, really crazy. The world is insane, probably, to them.
I have no clue.
I would say that they're very probably curious and just a lot of the times happier from what I've, viewed growing up. I mean, it really depends on the child, but I think, they're not aware of all the terrible things there are in the world, so it kind of shelters them in a way.
I think they look at it with more of an open heart and honesty.
I think they've experienced the world very loudly and very brightly, and they get overwhelmed a lot by situations that normally wouldn't be overwhelming to the normal person.
Hello, my name is Caitlin Shamro, and I'm going to be your host for today's podcast on the topic of autism, produced by myself, Grant Bossard, and Chandler O'Riordan. More specifically, we're going to be looking at how educational systems designed for children with autism differ from regular or public schools. By looking at interviews with educators, as well as background research, we will be exploring the costs and benefits of mainstreaming children with autism. Ultimately, we seek to answer the question of whether mainstreaming is a beneficial goal for students with autism. As we heard at the beginning of the podcast, the way people understand and think about the experiences of children with autism differ greatly. One way we will seek to answer our main question regarding mainstreaming children with autism is to compare the different attitudes of those who work in and out of the system. In order to get a better understanding of how mainstream schools and schools specialized to teach children with autism differ, we interviewed Anna and Jerry, two educators that work in either a regular public school or in a school system specifically designed for children with autism. We'll start by introducing Anna, a 20-year-old Bard student who since high school has worked in a couple of different specialized school systems designed for kids with autism. These include the Center for Spectrum Services in Kingston, New York, and another school in her hometown of Potsdam, New York.
So my first question for you is, how long have you been working with kids with autism?
So I have been working in special education generally for 4 years, and kids with autism specifically for 3 of those years. So I was 17, but I was a senior in high school. I volunteered for the whole year as a classroom aide in a 12-on-1 classroom, which is just like general special ed, students who don't have incredibly severe disabilities, but that was really awesome. They were amazing. And I just fell in love with special ed from there and started working in ABA classrooms over the summers. And it was really fabulous. And I also fell in love with that. And I've worked ABA pretty consistently for the past 3 years.
What was your job description or title?
So I was a classroom assistant. Each classroom has a classroom teacher and then a bunch of one-on-one aides. And the number of aides is dependent on the number of students in the classroom. So typically I'd be in a classroom with like 9 students. So there would be 9 aides and 1 teacher. Sometimes we'd get lucky and have like one more aide, and then sometimes we'd have not enough aides. But how it should go is it's one person to one student, and you switch either every hour or every half hour. So the student works with different people throughout the day on a variety of tasks. We use binders. In binders, they want to complete all of their daily activities. Maybe every half an hour, there's like a fine motor exercise or a general exercise that they do once an hour. And these tasks can be sort of whatever they need them to be. We had a student who we would teach how to shower, and that would actually involve like having her go take a shower, and we would like monitor and be like, okay, now you have to scrub your hair, and now you do this and this. And that was like specifically asked for by her parents. But there are other students we have who need to learn things like what a stop sign means, so they know when the cars are going to stop and it's going to be safe for them to cross the road. So there's lots of things like that. As an aide, you're not making plans. It's a lot of, you carry out the programs and you record the data from those programs.
The second educator we'll be introducing today is Jerry, who works at a public school in New Jersey.
What is your job or description title?
My description title that I usually give people is educator. Because the fact of it is I do many, many things. I teach a lot, but I also do administrative things. I've been an athletic director, a principal, a vice principal, a curriculum director, a supervisor of special education.
What is your role under this job description?
In this particular job, the bulk of it is helping to raise standardized test scores and optimizing student achievement. So that's done not only in the regular state testing that students have to take, but in an advanced placement psychology class that I teach as well.
And how was your experience under this job?
It's great. Sometimes what no instructor or educator can really have an effect on is how much students and parents care. So that part, sometimes they don't. When they do, however, it's wonderful. You can take a student as far as he or she wants to go, see some amazing growth.
What does the typical classroom look like?
Most classes, I'm guessing, in my school are probably 20 students or so, give or take. But there are some as low as even 5, but then some as high as 30.
What does your typical day look like?
Again, many classes, helping students raise standardized achievement scores for not just English, but an SAT, ACT class, math as well, and then advanced placement psychology.
To get a better understanding of the way that experiences of children with autism could differ in both of these school systems, we asked our interviewees about the different resources available for kids with autism in each of their schools. Anna talked mostly about the ABA system, or the Applied Behavioral Analysis System, and what that entails.
For those of us who don't know what ABA stands for, could you tell us a little bit about that program?
Yeah, so ABA is Applied Behavioral Analysis. It's a program that's essentially trying to get students to engage in more typical or appropriate behaviors by rewarding them. You start rewarding them with food or time on their laptop. And then it sort of transitions from that to the intrinsic reward of getting things right and learning more and more. It's a really cool program. Sometimes the goal is mainstreaming, sometimes it's not. It's incredibly individualized. It's based on the student. Each student has a behavioral specialist that creates a plan for them. So it's kind of like, okay, if Aiden throws himself on the ground and starts crying, then your response is this and this, and you can't do this because then he will do this. So it's very like regimented behavioral therapy, essentially.
I know you worked in the ABA system in Potsdam, where you live, but is that any different from the Center for Spectrum Services in Kingston, or did they work with the same kind of program?
Right. They work actually in an incredibly similar way. The only difference is that Potsdam is officially running an ABA program, and the Center for Spectrum Services has a program that's incredibly similar to ABA, but is not named as such. They do the exact same thing, basically, but I don't think that they're officially ABA certified.
Okay. So you mentioned aides and teachers and classroom assistants. Are there other positions besides those in the Center for Spectrum Services, or where you were working in Potsdam?
Something the Center for Spectrum Services had that was really cool was the crisis squad. It was like the director of behavioral services, who's this really cool guy named Niels, and I love him. And essentially, whenever a student has a serious behavioral issue, you would call in the crisis squad, and they would come and deal with that student, and they were all geared up, and they had the arm guards, and they were really cool. It was really smart. And when I was in public school, they did not have a crisis squad, probably because we didn't have the resources. But each teacher in each classroom had this special training that is called calm training. And then one or two classroom aides would get calm trained so that they could perform like special procedures, because there are a lot of very specific procedures that you have to go through. Like, you can't just pick a kid up. You have to do a thing called a scoop or a carry. And it takes a very specific individual to do that kind of stuff. Like, they're not going to just have, you know, like me, do the training, because I only work summers. Or at the Center for Spectrum Services, you know, it's only the crisis squad, which sucks because I really want to get calm trained, but I can't as of now. Hopefully one day. But yeah, so there are those people. There's also a person called a BCABA. That's the person who's the behavioral specialist. That person writes behavior plans and is in charge of like monitoring students. If they're having a very weird new behavior, then we'll go to that person and be like, hey, like, come observe Jimmy at this hour today because he's been doing XYZ and we need like a plan for how to handle that. So that's kind of the main positions in ABA.
As for Jerry's public school, they follow the requirement under the Individuals with Disability Education Act that all public schools are required to follow. It states that they must provide a free and appropriate public education through an Individualized Education Program, or IEP, to all eligible children. This program is essentially a plan that lays out what kinds of special education and support a child needs to succeed in school, and from the age of 3, is accessible to any child through their local public school. While talking to Jerry, he expanded a bit further on what an IEP is and what kinds of roles different people take on in this program.
What resources are available for students with autism at your school?
Yeah, the resources are in an IEP, Individualized Education Plan, which is part of what special ed students, students who are classified as needing extra help, receive. So the resources are what any public school would afford, which are whatever the student needs. And if the regular education classroom cannot satisfy the needs of the student, then the student has to be sent to an out-of-district placement. So within the school, there are case managers who are specific liaisons from educators to the parents of the student. And then there are special ed teachers who either have a resource room, which means a separate class for special education students, or they are in-class support teachers who work with a regular education teacher in the same classroom. So the placement of the child is dependent upon the severity of the disability and the IEP.
Now that we've met our interviewees and have an understanding of the types of resources available in each of their schools, we are going to move on to the question, what is the goal for children with autism in each of these school settings?
So you already kind of explained what the kids do on a day-to-day basis, but could you maybe walk us through a typical day, if there is one?
Yeah, there actually really is, because something about autism is the students really need routine. Their routine is incredibly important to them, so the days are very heavily regimented. You go in, you find out who's there and who's absent. The teacher will create a schedule for the day, putting people in half-hour blocks, sometimes an hour, depends what classroom you're in, like what the attention span of the students is. So anywhere from a half an hour to an hour. They're put into those blocks, the kids come in, they eat breakfast, they go into their blocks, they learn, you know, switching off teachers every half hour or hour as applicable. If it's a lower functioning classroom, they have regular scheduled bathroom times. If you have a higher functioning classroom, they could just tell you. But we have to kind of preempt that if it's a lower functioning classroom, which is typically what I work in. So break for lunch. Sometimes your class will have a circle time where they're sort of just supposed to participate in like a group activity together. If they're too low functioning, sometimes that's really not an option. So they may or may not have circle time, you know, more activities, get them ready to go home and then send them home. Yeah, it's a lot of like very highly regimented learning. We do have like playground time, or they'll have like gym programs. Ooh, they have a swimming program that they love, which is really cool. I had a student who didn't move a lot. It was very hard. He fell asleep all the time. And you'd get him in that pool and he would just swim around. He had so much fun. It was really cool to see.
That's awesome. So for, you mentioned the higher functioning kids, what are some of the things that you teach the kids who you're trying to eventually mainstream in order to prepare them for that kind of transition?
Yeah, it's a lot of social skills. It's being quiet in group settings or playing appropriately with other children, you know, learning when to talk, when not to talk. A lot of it is about like cooperative play and interacting with people in appropriate ways. I would say that's the brunt of it. Other than that, we're trying to teach them like typical stuff that someone their age would know, you know, like math and spelling, and they're pretty great at it. Some of them are actually like savantish, and it's really cool to see.
When do you think a child is deemed ready to be mainstream?
I mean, that's definitely a decision above my pay grade, but it's a lot of, it's consultation with the teacher and the parents. The parents have to be ready to mainstream the child. Like, ultimately, it's their decision. Sometimes the parents will push for it. Sometimes they won't. They don't think their kid's ready. But yeah, it's a lot of talking to the teacher. It's meeting with the BCABA. There are special boards where parents will have yearly meetings with special education coordinators who will kind of discuss what's best for their child and what programs they'd like to put them in next year. And a lot of the time, mainstreaming will be brought up there. But yeah, so it's pretty much down to the parents' decision and whether or not the school approves that decision. So the school has to believe the child's ready and the parents have to want the child to be mainstreamed.
Anna explains a lot in this section of the interview. Planning to mainstream a child with autism comes with learning social skills, cooperative play, in addition to basic schooling like math and spelling. Now we're going to hear Jerry answer similar questions.
What does your typical day look like?
Many classes, helping students raise standardized achievement scores for not just English, but an SAT, ACT class, math as well, and then advanced placement psychology.
How does your school approach the incorporation of kids with autism into the mainstream classroom environment?
Yeah, again, it totally depends upon the severity of the disability of the student. So you could have a student in a class whose disability is not determined to be that great, and the student needs no extra help whatsoever. There might be an IEP or a 504, sometimes perhaps, which is another legal document affording special educational alterations for a child. And you have to do what's in the document. So that's one way of adapting autistic kids into the class. And then another one, it depends. If a student needs an extra teacher, they have what's called in-class support or special ed teachers in the classroom with the regular teacher. And there are sometimes when students have such a severe difficulty with autism that they literally cannot be taught in a mainstream classroom. And as a supervisor of special education, I created two different programs for that sort of thing. And it's not as hard as it would appear. You simply need to interpret the testing and the diagnosis of the autism and determine whether the student could be placed in what's legally called the least restrictive environment. So the least restrictive environment for all of us, we hope, is the regular mainstream class. If students can't be successful there, then the least restrictive environment is another and more restrictive environment. For example, an autistic child who has not very many difficulties might well be in a regular mainstream class with no extra help whatsoever. And then the program that I had was severe autistic difficulties to the degree where they really couldn't even communicate verbally. And they needed special help to have an environment that met their needs.
A study by Griffith University in 2016 showed that autism usually develops reactive versus proactive teaching and support from teachers to students. Also, the more knowledge, awareness, and understanding of autism by teachers usually results in a favorable outcome for the student with autism. However, research has also shown that belonging to a mainstream culture helps children with autism in a myriad of ways. Now that we have heard about the resources available for children with autism and the goals for these students in each school setting, we will now introduce another important aspect to consider when deciding whether to mainstream a child with autism. Attitudes of students and teachers can have a lasting impact on a child's education. Studies have shown that an environment more accepting of a child's autistic identity will assist the education of a child with autism by boosting self-acceptance and increasing enjoyable social interactions. Both interviewees discussed their own stereotypes and attitudes towards children with autism in a classroom setting, as well as the stereotypes held by other teachers and students.
How do you think your understanding of autism has changed working with kids with autism?
You learn a lot about like the traits of an autistic person and what a diagnosis involves. And it's really interesting because it becomes a lot more visible to you. I think that we as a society really want people with disabilities to be invisible. And one thing that working in special education does is you realize just how invisible we try to make these people. So I feel like I never saw people with disabilities before I started working in special education. And now, like, I go out in public and I'm like, oh, that's an aid worker with a student. That's so nice to see them going to the mall together. It was something that was so invisible to me. And then it's like you're granted the ability to see it by working in the programs, which I would say is the most noteworthy thing about working in special education. That's something that I've gained that has been really like interesting.
So if you had heard the word autism before you started working with kids in this program, what do you think would have come to mind that was different than now?
I would say I thought of like children with autism as like savants, because I think that that's how they're portrayed a lot in media. I was like, oh, like a person with autism, I bet they can like do puzzles really fast, or like, you know, like I think every child must have like a savantish tendency, and that's not the case. And sometimes you can have children with like really profound disabilities and they all stem from autism, and it's sad, but like the media portrayal doesn't want to show kids with incredibly profound disabilities. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that's changed a lot for me. When I think of autism, like I think of my students that I had the first year out of high school, the first summer that I worked ABA, and I just had these students and they had a lot of issues functioning typically. And it was like very eye-opening for me.
Anna's not the only one who notices the invisibility of the disorder. Many parents complain about the fact that their child's disorder is invisible. When people see a child misbehaving in public, they often shake their heads in disapproval, chalking it up to be bad parenting or a difficult child. Explaining a child's behavior to someone who does not see the child as having autism can be a difficult thing for parents to do. What may contribute to the invisibility of the disorder is the narrative that all children with autism have savant skills. This is, of course, escalated by the media, which Anna discusses when explaining how teachers who work in a public school understand and treat students with autism.
So do you think teachers who work in like public schools have this same kind of view that's based so strongly in the media?
From what I've experienced as both a public school student and a person who works in a public school with students with disabilities, the mainstream teachers have almost no interaction with students with disabilities. So I wouldn't believe that they know anything about them, besides the fact that at 2:30, when students take their walks down the hallway, you're going to hear some screaming, which, you know, stereotypy and like skimming. But people just hear it as screaming. So, you know, teachers will be like, but they won't know like the source, why it's happening. Yeah, for the most part, public school teachers don't really know anything about the programs. They're kept really isolated. Actually, the BOCES program is completely different from the public school programs for like mainstream education. So yeah, I don't know if the teachers know anything about students with disabilities. Some are better than others, I'll say that.
And so do you think like the students hold the same kind of view or experience the same distancing from these kids as well?
Oh yeah. Some are really great. And it was not the people who you would expect. I would walk down the hallway with some of them and people that had known me forever would just be like, hi, and then like walk away because they just didn't know how to interact. I don't know that this is particularly based in anything, but I found that honors students and like AP students did not know how to interact with my kids. And this is actually like a relatively typical finding in that you find that the honors students typically have parents who are like doctors and professors in my town. And you know, sometimes there aren't. I'm not gonna like paint anyone into like a box, but typically like wealthier people actually send their children away when they have disabilities, and poorer people don't have that option. And so their children live with them. Their children are the ones that end up in special education. And typically the people who don't have as much money, the students who don't have as much money are the ones who recognize and interact with the students with disabilities incredibly normally. It was really weird because this is not like nice of me to say, but they were like the rednecky kids. That's like how they referred to themselves. You know, we live on the Canadian border in the country, and the rednecky kids, you know, we didn't really interact much. And then when like I started working in special education, we started interacting a lot because they hang out with the students, you know, they're like pals with them. And it was really, really, really cool to see.
The observation Anna makes about which students are more accepting or better at interacting with students with autism is an interesting point. Perhaps it comes from the fact that families with children with autism have parents who are more likely to work from home with fewer hours and also earn 56% less than other parents. A study done by Sharp and Baker in 2007 found that survey respondents who had children with autism sacrificed financial security to provide the therapy and support necessary for their child with autism. Parents with children with autism often have to fund medical interventions and front medical or therapy expenses without being reimbursed, all while having relatively lower income. For these reasons, it would make sense that students with lower SES would be more likely to be around others with autism, and therefore more able to interact with them. From Anna, we hear that children with autism are definitely treated differently by students and teachers in a public school setting than students without autism. However, this is only one perspective, and Jerry seems to have a different opinion.
Do you think kids with autism at your school are treated differently than the kids without autism, either by the administration or the student body?
No, not at all. Certainly not by any students or teachers. And the only way that administrators treat them differently is because they have to, by the law. If they have an IEP, the administrators have to follow the law, which would entail treating them differently.
How do typical students view children with autism at your school?
Typical students and all students couldn't care less. From a 16-year-old's point of view, it's real simple. Is this person nice to me, or is this person, in their words, a jerk to me? They couldn't care less about labels.
Jerry and Anna provide two very different opinions regarding how children with autism are treated by students and teachers of public schools. We thought that maybe this difference in opinion had something to do with the demographics of the schools. Anna worked in a very rural, conservative town in upstate New York, while Jerry works in a more urban and liberal area. Perhaps the more liberal group would be more understanding of the needs of students and classmates with autism. This could mean that location and demographics may be something to consider when parents are making the decision to mainstream their child with autism.
When describing his experience with children with autism, Jerry touched on three different aspects supported by literature. The first being that many people believe that vaccines cause autism.
What comes to mind when you hear the word autism?
Sadly, one thing that I think of is the completely unfounded rumor that it came from vaccines. That's a really damaging lie because it actually was promulgated first by a British doctor who had his license taken away. But people, unfortunately, these days believe sometimes what they believe on the internet, and it's not true. And that could lead to terrible damage, kids not being vaccinated who should, and the diseases that come up from that. Typically, when you think of the word autism, it means difficulty in social interactions. And the spectrum is anywhere from slight difficulties to the degree that most folks wouldn't even think that there was an issue to can't even communicate verbally at all, just gestures. And the spectrum is anywhere from minor to the greatly severe. And another thing that I think of when I hear the word autism is that there are many more children who have autism. Well, there's two things that come to my mind with that assertion. One is, it's not possible that there were no autistic people for thousands and thousands of years. There simply wasn't the designation as such. So I can think back to students that I went to school with decades ago before there was a diagnosis of autism, and likely they would be diagnosed as being autistic today. We just accepted that they were a little different and it wasn't a big deal. And the truth of it is, that's how most students even today view that. The other thing that I think of when I hear the word autism, when people are looking for the reason, if indeed there are more people with autism, but the only study that I ever saw that had some level of credibility suggested that perhaps more children are coming into the world with autistic difficulties because more parents are having children later in their lives. I don't know that that's true, but my own mother had her first child when she was 19 years old. My wife and I didn't have our first child until I believe she was 31. And it's not just the female, it's the male as well. It's both being significantly older.
How do you think other people understand autism?
I think that, unfortunately, a lot of people don't understand it. They think of, oh, vaccines cause that. The other one is, if they don't know what it really means, they think of Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man. So they don't really know what it means, sadly.
Besides the idea of vaccines causing autism being wrong, the entire argument about not wanting to vaccinate children against diseases that could literally kill them because of the chance that they might get autism is essentially saying that they would rather their child be dead than have autism. If this view is incorporated into either school system, chances are the child will not grow into their full potential. Jerry also describes one of the main categories of impairment according to the DSM-5's account of autism. Deficits in social communication and social interaction are included in the DSM-5 as a diagnosis criteria. In this way, his understanding of autism is accurate according to the DSM-5. A school that understands that children with autism have this impairment and also know how to best incorporate these deficits into their education will be the optimal place for the student with autism to learn. One last thing Jerry mentioned regarding his own experience is the idea that autism was not always diagnosed the way it is today. Epidemiologists refer to this idea as the autism epidemic. While we don't really know what is causing the epidemic, there are a few theories discussed in a study done in 2015 by Liu and Bierman. It could be the case that autism is actually more prevalent in today's world than in the past. It could also be that psychologists are better at recognizing autism, or that parents are more likely to discuss the possibility of their child having autism and therefore seeking out treatment. Whatever the reason, there seems to be an increase in the amount of parents who need answers on where best to give their child an education. To redirect back to our main question of this podcast, whether or not mainstreaming is a beneficial goal for students with autism, we want to leave you with Jerry and Anna's concluding thoughts.
I think mainstreaming overall is positive. I think it's kind of sad that we ask students to like normalize themselves to enter these classrooms, because a lot of ABA, well, incredibly positive, right? Like, we live in a society where people act a specific way. And so if you want to function in that society, you need to act that way. Unfortunately, that's not going to change. So what we can try and do for our students is push them in that direction. It's sad. At what point are you normalizing? At what point do you want to be normalizing? Should we allow students to just go on and repeat commercials or swing their hands? That's a type of self-stimulating behavior. It's tough because you want to draw the line between getting a student to a point where they can go to a typical classroom and learn, because it's infinitely better for them if they have the capability to do that. You don't want to get stuck in the special education system, or else you're going to be there forever. And then a student that has the potential to live a quote unquote normal life doesn't ever actually get to fulfill that potential because they have gotten stuck in a system that doesn't really care to like push them. It's challenging. I think it would be amazing if we allowed students with autism to just enter mainstreaming because they're smart and allow them to sort of keep their little quirks and idiosyncrasies that make them so wonderful. But unfortunately, we don't really live in a society where that's acceptable. So I think that there's sort of a give and take. Like, you need to think about how can we get these students into situations that are helpful for them while also not dulling who they are as people. So that's kind of like the hard part of ABA. But, you know, it's something you have to deal with. But I think overall, it's like a really good program. I've seen students benefit from it incredibly. And if the goal is mainstreaming, then you can get your students there for sure. And it's ultimately probably good for them.
Many, many classes across the United States of America have students with autistic qualities and been diagnosed as being autistic. As you know, autism, however, is an incredibly broad category, and so broad, in fact, that they use the word spectrum, suggesting that a slight and mild disability of autism, or a case of a friend of mine who had a child who was autistic, was severe, and the child literally could not communicate in a typical verbal way. They can only communicate via physical actions. And it goes back to something that I've said to myself many times. I'm sure back in the day, when I was a young person, I'm sure there were students who would have been considered autistic 40 years later, but we didn't have such a thing. So I think that we just sort of accepted that, you know, someone's a little different. And as long as there's no problems, then that's fine. Not a problem being different.
Considering all of the information that we have heard in this podcast about mainstreaming children with autism and how attitudes may influence this decision, we ultimately believe that answer is dependent on the individual child with autism. Both interviewees and the research presented seem to support placing children in their own least restrictive environment. However, it is important to continue to work toward educating people on autism in order to try to erase the stigma that surrounds it, thereby making the mainstreaming process an easier one. We hope this podcast can create a more regular dialogue among teachers, parents, and students. We hope you enjoyed it, and thank you for listening.